This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Dead by Sunset by Anne Rule, narrated by Richard Ferrone. This book is copyrighted 1995 by Anne Rule. This recording is copyrighted 2003 by Recorded Books. When attorney Cheryl Keaton's brutally bludgeoned body was found in her van in the fast lane of an Oregon freeway, her husband, Brad Cunningham, was the likely suspect. But there was no solid evidence linking him to the crime. He married again for the fifth time, and for his stunning wife, a physician named Sarah, the marriage gradually becomes a nightmare. And now, Dead by Sunset.
Written laws, which were like spiders' webs and would catch, it is true, the weak and poor, but could easily be broken by the mighty and the rich. Anacharsis, 6th century B.C. Violence and injury enclose in their net all that do such things, and generally return upon him who began. Lucretius, 99-55 B.C. Part 1. The Crime. Chapter 1. September 21st, 1986, was a warm and beautiful Sunday in Portland, in the whole state of Oregon, for that matter. With any luck, the winter rains of the Northwest were a safe 2 months away. The temperature had topped off at 69 degrees about 4 that afternoon, and even at 9 p.m. it was still a relatively balmy 58 degrees. Randall Kelly Blyton had traveled west on Highway 26, the Sunset Highway, earlier that evening, driving his youngsters back to their mother's home in Beaverton after their weekend visitation with him. A handsome, athletic-looking man with dark hair and a mustache, Blyton was in his 20s, a truck salesman. His divorce from his wife was amicable, and he was in a good mood as he headed back toward Portland along the same route. The Sunset Highway, which is actually a freeway, can often be a commuter's nightmare. It runs northwest from the center of Portland, past the OMSI Zoo, and through forest-like parks. Somewhere near the crossroads of Sylvan, the Multnomah, Washington County line sign flashes by almost subliminally. Then the freeway angles toward the Pacific Ocean beaches as it skirts Beaverton and the little town of Hillsboro. The land drops away past Sylvan, giving the area its name, West Slope. Route 8 trails off the Sunset Highway down the curves of the slope, past pleasant neighborhoods until it runs through a commercial zone indistinguishable from similar zones anywhere in America. Pizza parlors, supermarkets, car dealers, strip malls. Approaching Hillsboro, the Washington County seat, Route 8, the TV highway, slices through what was only recently farmland. The Tualatin River Valley, once richly agricultural, is now a technological wonderland. Its endless woods are dwindling, and the area has become known as the Silicon Forest. There are acres and acres of corporate parks in Washington County now. Intel, Fujitsu, NEC, and Tektronix. Intel is already the largest single employer in Oregon. Soon there will be more workers in the computer and electronics industry in Oregon than there are timber employees. Apparently serenely untroubled by the encroachment of modern technology, the Sisters of St. Mary have been stationed along the TV highway for many years, their nunnery and school on the left, their home for wayward boys on the right. In an instant, Route 8 becomes 10th Avenue in Hillsboro. A left turn on Main Street leads toward the old city center and the county courthouse. Main Street is idyllically lined with wide lawns, wonderful old houses with gingerbread touches, jack-o'-lanterns at Halloween, and spectacular lights during the Christmas season. but it hasn't fared so well commercially since the new Target store and the mall went up south of town. Its chief businesses are antique stores and, except for the Copperstone restaurant and cocktail lounge, the kind of restaurants where ladies linger over tea. The Washington County Courthouse is surrounded by manicured grounds with magnolias and towering sequoias planted more than a century ago. It smells like a courthouse, at least the original structure does. Wax, dust, the daily lunchroom special, and old paint baking on radiators. The people employed there are comfortable and at home, bantering with one another as they go about their work. The people who come there on all manner of missions are more often than not angry, worried, grieving, frightened, annoyed, or apprehensive. Some walk away with a sense of justice done, and some don't walk away at all. They are handcuffed and locked up in the jail next door. Not far from the courthouse, something terrible happened on the Sunset Highway on September 21, 1986, at the Sylvan Marker just inside Washington County. And in the end, it would all be settled in this courthouse as Christmas lights glowed in the branches of a tall fir on the corner of Main and First Streets, and icy rain pelted court watchers and witnesses alike. The end would be a long time coming. It was about 8:30 on that Sunday night in September, and dark enough so that Randy Blyton needed his headlights to see what lay ahead of him on the curving Sunset Highway. He was startled as he came around one of those curves near Sylvan in the West Slope area and saw that cars a half mile ahead of him were suddenly swerving out of the fast lane into the right-hand lane. It looked as if there might be something in the road ahead that they hadn't been able to see until the last moment. A dead animal, perhaps, or maybe a truck tire. Whatever it was, it had to be dangerous. A last-minute lane switch only worked if the right lane was clear. Blyton traveled another 100 feet, and now he could make out the dark hulk of a Toyota van turned crossways on the freeway. Its lights were off, and it was in a perilous position, completely blocking the fast lane. Luckily, the drivers ahead of Blyton had been alert, but it would be only a matter of time before someone came around the curve in the fast lane and smashed into the van. People usually drove the Sunset Highway between 55 and 65 miles an hour, and a crash like that would undoubtedly escalate rapidly into a fatal multi-car pileup. Blyton was grateful that, for the moment at least, the freeway was not heavily traveled, and that was only a freak circumstance. At 8:30 on a Sunday night after a weekend of good weather, there had to be hundreds of vehicles heading back to Portland from the coast. Randy Blyton's first inclination was to swerve around the van. He had things to do at home.
"I was going to go on by, too," he later recalled. "But then I spotted the silhouette of an infant seat in the van. I couldn't ignore that. I'd just left my own kids, and I could never live with myself if there was a baby or a little kid in that van."
Blyton's reflexes were good. He tapped his brakes, pulled his car over on the right shoulder, grabbed a couple of flares, and then ran across the freeway toward the van. As he got close to it, he could see that it was perpendicular to the median that separated the eastbound and westbound lanes, its front bumper repeatedly tapping the concrete Jersey barriers. The van's engine was still turning over, and it was in gear, inching forward and then being held back by the barriers. Blyton knew that he was as much a sitting duck as the Toyota if a car came around the curve, and he hurriedly lit the flares and set them out in the fast lane to warn motorists in time, he hoped, to veer to the right. He had no idea what he might find as he reached for the driver's door handle of the van, possibly someone who had had a stroke or a heart attack. It might even be a driverless vehicle that had slipped its brakes and somehow ended up on the freeway. In 1986, at this point on the sunset, there were still some neighborhood streets from which cars could enter the freeway as if the sunset was merely another intersection. Southwest 79th, just to the south of the accident, was one of those streets. Maybe the driver of the van, unfamiliar with the sunset's eccentricities, had turned far too widely and rammed into the barriers. Blyton opened the driver's side door. The van was not empty. He could make out a figure lying on the front seat. The person's legs were near the gear shift console and extended over the driver's seat. The back was on the passenger seat, and the head was tucked into the chest and drooping over toward the floor. He didn't know if it was a man or woman, but he saw a smallish loafer-type shoe on one foot that looked feminine. There was no time for Blyton to try to figure out who the driver was or how he or she had ended up crosswise on the freeway. He stepped up into the driver's side, pushing the legs out of the way as much as he could. Now he could see that there was a woman's purse jammed between the accelerator and the firewall. That would explain why the van continued to move forward. Blyton felt along the dash to try to find the switch for the emergency flashers, but he couldn't locate it. He didn't know that it was overhead. There was the child's car seat right behind the driver's seat. It was empty, but that didn't make Blyton feel much better. The baby could be on the floor someplace. Counting on the flares to warn other cars to go around, he slid the side passenger door open and patted the floor and seats with his hands. Everything he touched was wet, and he realized why it had been so hard to see through the driver's side window. Something dark splattered the glass. On some level, he knew he was running his hands through pooled blood, but finding the baby that might be there was more important than anything else. When he found nothing, he ran to the back of the van, opened the hatchback, and looked in. No baby. Thank God. No baby. Instinctively, Blyton wiped his hands down his shirt and pants, wanting to get the wet, iodine-smelling stuff off them. He shuddered, but he didn't stop to consider how there could be blood if the van hadn't been hit by another vehicle. He ran back to the driver's door, hopped into the van, expertly shifted into reverse, and backed the van across the freeway and onto the shoulder of 79th, where it met the Sunset Highway. Only when he had assured himself that the Toyota was no longer in danger of being hit by oncoming traffic did Blyton turn to look closely at the person lying across the seat. He thought it was a woman. Her hair was short and dark, but he didn't know if she was young or old. She didn't respond to his questions, but he still kept asking, "Are you okay? Are you hurt?" Blyton ran around to the front passenger door and found it was slightly ajar. He opened it and picked up the woman's hand, feeling for a pulse in her wrist. There was no reassuring beat. He could see blood on her face, and one of her eyes protruded grotesquely, as big as a hard-boiled egg. Even if he had known this woman, he would never have recognized her. His first thought was that he had to get help for her. Maybe she did have a pulse, but too faint for him to detect. He ran back to the driver's side and reached in, running his hands along the dash, searching frantically again for the emergency flasher's switch. He finally saw it overhead and switched them on. They clicked in eerie rhythm, but that was the only sound he heard. The woman wasn't breathing. Blyton stuck more flares in the gravel along the shoulder of the freeway, and traffic in both lanes slowed down as it passed, hundreds of cars whose occupants had no idea how close they had come to being in a massive fatal pileup. Blyton then looked around for a place where he could call for help. He saw lights along Southwest 79th, the street that ran at a right angle onto the Sunset Highway. No one responded to his knock at the first house, even though he could hear voices inside. He pounded on the door of the second house, and a young woman opened it. "There's a bad accident on the freeway," he gasped. "Call an ambulance. I'm going back out there." It was hard to judge the passage of time, but Blyton estimated that about 10 minutes had passed since he first saw the Toyota van angled crazily across the freeway. Cars were inching by in a single lane now, and he caught glimpses of curious faces darting a look at what appeared to be nothing more than a roadside breakdown. The woman who lay across the seat hadn't moved. Sirens wailed somewhere in the distance, and soon Blyton could see the flashing red lights of an ambulance. Thomas Stewart Duffy Jr., Tom, was on duty at Washington County Fire District No. 1, the West Slope Station, that Sunday night. The station was just east of the IGA supermarket between Canyon Drive and Canyon Lane at Southwest 78th Street. The alarm bell sounded at 20:44:50, 8:44 p.m. and 50 seconds, and the call came in as a probable DOA on the Sunset Highway. There were a lot of calls from the Sunset, and a fair amount of them were fatals, so Tom Duffy and his partner Mike Moran, both paramedics, were familiar with the area. Running for their rig, a Chevrolet van, the two men leaped in and headed up Canyon Lane, turned left on West Slope Drive, and then went northbound on 79th toward the Sunset Highway. It was an older neighborhood with houses on big lots set far off the street and well apart from each other. Huge trees edged the narrow roadway, and there were no street lights. The medics' rig lights were on, but they still had trouble seeing until they spotted the flares at the southwest corner of the Sunset and 79th. In a heartbeat, the quiet, dark street ended in a usually roaring freeway. That night, they saw cars backed up to the west for miles. It had taken them 2 minutes and 20 seconds to reach the site. Tom Duffy was a former Army combat medic who served in Vietnam. He had worked for 13 years as a paramedic with the Washington County Fire District and Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. Altogether, he had over 28 years in the medical field. Very tall and lean, he rarely smiled. He had seen people die in all manner of ways. He had seen scores of fatal accidents, and they always bothered him. He had long since learned to shut his mind to the terrible things he saw during those moments when he fought to save lives, but he never really forgot, and he would have almost crystalline recall of that Sunday night. Duffy and Moran saw a blue Toyota van parked facing north along 79th. A man ran up to them shouting, "A lady's in the van. She's hurt really bad." "How long has it been since the accident?" Duffy asked. "I don't know for sure. It took me a while to find a phone. I think about 15 minutes, the man answered. "We saw the van," Duffy would remember, "and we assessed the situation quickly. We saw no hazards around it, no power lines down or gas leaking. There was very little damage to the van itself." As for the man who had run up to him, Randy Blyton, Duffy didn't know who he was, and he had no idea what had happened. Blyton's clothes were streaked with dark stains that could have been blood. The van didn't look wrecked. For all Duffy knew, he and Moran might be walking into trouble. The three men went over to the van, and Blyton opened the passenger door so the paramedics could see the woman inside. "She's in here," he said. "The van was crosswise over there in the fast lane." Duffy attempted to find some sign of life in the woman who lay sprawled across the front seat in the shadows of the van. He put a hand on her shoulder and asked, "Are you all right?" There was no response. He exerted more pressure and gave the woman a trapezius squeeze on her shoulder muscle. Someone even semi-conscious would have reacted to that force. There was no response. Duffy held sensitive fingers to the carotid artery along the side of her neck and felt nothing. "There was no response at all," he would remember. "I could palpate no pulse. No respiration. Turning to Mike Moran and three firefighters who had arrived at the scene in a fire truck, he said, "We need to get her out of this van fast." They maneuvered her limp body out of the front seat with extreme caution, careful not to aggravate any cervical spinal injuries she might have sustained in the accident. They circled her neck with a bracing collar so that her spinal processes wouldn't be jostled as they took her out of the van. If by some miracle she was alive, they didn't want her to be paralyzed. They placed her on the road beside the van and began attempts to resuscitate her, even though they were quite sure it was an exercise in futility. The gravelly shoulder alongside the Sunset Highway now bristled with people who wanted to help when there was no longer any way to help. A Buck ambulance and its crew, Mike Moran and Tom Duffy, the firefighters and EMTs, and a half-dozen state police. In the yellow rays of headlights and flashlights, they could all see that the victim who lay on the ground had suffered massive trauma. The top of her head was, in the blunt words of an observer, like mincemeat. One of the paramedics thought he saw brain matter leaking. There was so much blood, so terribly much blood. It was as thick as curdled sour milk already beginning to coagulate. Duffy knew that meant that more than 5 or 10 minutes had passed since the woman had last bled freely. Depending on her own particular clotting factor profile, it might have been up to half an hour. There was no hope of saving her. The dead do not bleed. The patient fit into the category of a patient who could not possibly be resuscitated, he would say later. Not at all. She was in cardiopulmonary arrest. That meant her heart no longer beat, her lungs no longer drew breath. Even without the tremendous loss of blood, the assault to the brain itself would have been fatal. An injured brain responds by swelling, and as it does so, it bulges into centers that control heart rhythm and breathing, effectively shutting down all activity needed to continue life. By 8:53 p.m., when Oregon State Police Traffic Officer David Fife arrived, the paramedics had given up. There was no hope. The victim lay still, covered partially by a blanket. Fife walked around the Toyota van and saw it had virtually no damage. But when he lifted the blanket to look at the dead woman, he was appalled at the wounds on her head. How could she have suffered such massive injuries when the van was scarcely marred at all? Fife moved his patrol unit to the west of the scene and turned on his overheads and emergency lights to warn the drivers who were inching along the Sunset Highway. They weren't going to get to Portland by this route, not for a long time. When his sergeant, James Hinckley, who had been dispatched from the Beaverton substation, arrived, Fife turned the immediate scene over to him and pulled out his camera. He took 36 photographs of the victim and the Toyota van, routine for any accident. By this time, senior troopers Bill Duggan and Lloyd Bile, along with Washington County Chief Criminal Deputy D.A. Bob Herman, had also arrived to join the group of investigators at the nightmarish scene on the Sunset Highway. Tom Duffy and his fellow paramedics had quickly reassured themselves that the dead woman had been all alone in the van. Just as with Randy Blyton, breath had caught in their throats when they noticed the child's car seat behind the driver's seat of the van. They knew the woman was beyond their help. They did not know if a baby or a toddler lay somewhere in the darkest spaces of the van or was perhaps caught beneath a seat. They steeled themselves to feel with their bare hands all around the inside of the van, running their fingers through the rapidly cooling blood that had spattered, stained, and pooled there. Finally, they were satisfied that the child who used that safety seat had not been present in the van when the woman died. The paramedics' hands and arms came away covered with the blood of the female victim. There was a lot of blood, Duffy would recall much later. A pool of clotted blood, a big circular pool on the carpet behind the passenger seat. There was blood on the ceiling and on the inside of the windows. Blood has its own smell, metallic, and that odor clung to the paramedics now. No one knew who the dead woman was. No one knew what had happened to her. But Tom Duffy was certain of one thing. He had seen literally thousands of car wrecks, and he knew that he was not looking at the aftermath of an automobile accident. He was looking at a crime scene. The mechanisms of injury, the damage to this vehicle, could not have produced what we found, he said later. The blood on this person was dried and clotted. There was absolutely no sign of life. The Oregon troopers came to a similar conclusion. A slight dent, a few shards of glass from a broken signal light, and a couple of paint chips out by the Jersey barriers that divided the freeway were the only signs that the van had hit anything. The woman hadn't died in an accident. Her injuries had nothing to do with this wreck. There are always acronyms for official records. Those on the scene at the Sunset Highway used familiar shortcuts now as they filled out forms. DOS, Dead on Scene, MVA, Motor Vehicle Accident, and finally, POSS, Possible Homicide. And because this bizarre incident seemed indeed to be a POSS, Oregon State Police Sergeant Hinckley radioed in a request that detectives from the OSP Criminal Division respond to the scene. In Oregon, the state police investigate homicides and other felonies as well as traffic accidents. Detective Jerry Finch wasn't on call that night, but he was the first investigator the dispatcher could raise. Finch ran to his unmarked Ford LTD-2 and headed for the Cedar Mill home of Detective Jim Ayers. Ayers, in his mid-30s, had been assigned to the Beaverton OSP station for 3 years and was just arriving home from an evening out when he heard the crunch of tires on gravel and saw Finch's car turn into his driveway. Finch told Ayers they had a call out to a possible homicide. Jim Ayers had investigated all manner of felonies in his 14-year career with the Oregon State Police. Like most officers who hired on as troopers, he was tall and well-muscled. He had thick, wavy hair and a rumbling, deep voice. He had worked the road for 8 years investigating accidents. And like Tom Duffy, like all cops and all paramedics, he had seen too much tragedy. But he had also learned what was normal tragedy, if there could be such a thing, and what was abnormal tragedy. Ayers had become an expert in both arson investigation and psychosexual crimes, and he had investigated innumerable homicides. Jerry Finch had a few years on him, both in age and in experience. Together, the two men drove to the scene at 79th and the Sunset, not knowing what to expect. The best detectives are not tough. If they were, they would not have the special intuitive sense that enables them to see what laymen cannot. And Jim Ayers was one of the very best. But like his peers, he usually managed to hide his own pain over what one human can do to another behind a veneer of black humor and professional distance. It was 2 minutes after 10 p.m. when Finch and Ayers arrived at the scene, and as Ayers gazed down at the slender woman who lay on the freeway shoulder, her face and head disfigured by some tremendous force that had bludgeoned her again and again, he was still the complete detective, curious and contemplative. The two detectives walked around the blue Toyota van and saw the minor damage to its right front end and where a turn signal lens was broken out. There was a buckle in the roof of the van on the right. That could be explained easily enough. It was unibody construction, and a blow to the front end would ripple back along the side. Randy Blyton was still on the scene, and he told Finch and Ayers how he had found the van butting against the median barrier of the freeway. That would have broken the signal light. They found the signal lens itself lying on the freeway in the fast lane, and they also saw the beige purse that had been forcing the accelerator down before Blyton kicked it away. It would have been enough to keep the engine running while the car was in gear. With flashlights, Finch and Ayers looked into the van, playing light over the child's car seat, the blood spatter on the interior roof, the splash of blood on the hump over the transmission, and the pools of blood on the floor behind the front seats. A white plastic produce bag fluttered on the passenger side floor. It, too, bore bloodstains. The van would have to be processed in daylight, but Jim Ayers had already come to a bleak conclusion based on the physical evidence he saw and on Blyton's description of how he found the victim and his recollection that the driver's side window had been rolled partway down. "I felt the victim had been beaten while she was in the vehicle," he would say later. "My conclusion was that whoever had beaten her had intended to send it, the van, across the eastbound lanes of the Sunset Highway so that it would be hit by other vehicles." Had that happened, the cars approaching at 55 to 65 miles an hour would have rounded the curve and smashed into the driver's side of the Toyota van. Even if the van hadn't burst into flames, that would have destroyed every bit of evidence on the woman's body and in the vehicle itself. The massive head injuries she had suffered would have been attributed to the accident. Worse, in all likelihood, she would not have been the only fatality. State policemen have seen too many chain reaction accidents in which a dozen or more people die. Met by the horrifying sight of another vehicle directly in front of them, drivers cannot stop or even take evasive action. Usually, chain reaction pileups happen on foggy nights or when smoke from burning crops drifts across a highway. But this van, deliberately left crosswise in the fast lane of the Sunset, would have been like a brick wall appearing suddenly in the night. Clearly, whoever had bludgeoned the woman to death had not given a thought to how many more might die. All he or she had cared about was that the crime of murder would be covered up in a grinding collision of jagged steel, flying glass shards, and broken bodies. The dead woman's purse contained her driver's license and other identifying documents, or rather it contained some woman's identification. This woman, lying beside the road, was so disfigured by her beating that it was impossible to be sure that she was the woman whose picture appeared on the driver's license. However, given the laws of probability, Ayers and Finch were reasonably sure that the purse belonged to the victim. The address on her license was 231 Northeast Scott in Gresham, a suburb about as far east of downtown Portland as the accident scene was west. Ayers and Finch had just dispatched Senior Trooper Al Corson to the Gresham address to notify the victim's next of kin of her death when Finch carefully lifted a checkbook from her purse. "Look," he commented to Ayers. "These checks are personalized, and the address is different than the one on her registration." The checks bore the same name as the driver's license, Cheryl Keaton. However, the address imprinted on the checks was 2400 Southwest 81st, located on the west slope, only 0.3 mile from where they now stood. The woman lying on the ground was probably Cheryl Keaton, whose date of birth was listed on her driver's license as October 27th, 1949. That would make her less than a month away from her 37th birthday. The height and weight on the license seemed to fit the slender victim. Hair color didn't matter much anymore on a driver's license. Women changed their hair shade so often. But it was listed as brown, and the victim's hair appeared to be brown, although it was now matted with dried blood. "I don't think she lived in Gresham," Finch told Ayers. "I think that's an old address. You hang in here, and I'll take a run up to the address on 81st. Oregon State Police Sergeant Greg Baxter radioed the Portland Police Department dispatcher, who relayed a message to Al Corson, calling him back from Gresham. The next of kin of the victim were no longer there. Ayers was relieved to let Jerry Finch notify whoever might be waiting at the West Slope address for Cheryl Keaton to come home. Of all the responsibilities of a policeman's profession, that was always the hardest. Sometimes the survivors scream, and sometimes they stare unbelieving at the officers who bring them tragic news. Ayers wanted to be sure that the tow truck driver from Jim Collins Towing understood that the Toyota van was a vital piece of evidence and should be hooked up to the tow rig with extreme care. Collins's own son, Harley, had arrived to remove the van from the edge of the sunset. "I told him not to touch it any more than he had to, and not to go inside at all," Ayers said later. "Not to strap the steering wheel the way they usually do." Harley Collins said he would be careful and promised to lock the van behind the cyclone fence of Jim Collins's personal yard so that no one could come near it. Ayers felt better hearing that. Although he didn't know the tow driver, he knew that the tow company's owner was reliable. All the steps that were post-tragedy protocol had been followed. The investigators at the scene radioed a request for Eugene Jacobus, the chief deputy medical examiner for Washington County. The body was released to Jacobus at 11:35 p.m. The hands were bagged, and Jacobus was careful to see that the body itself was placed in a fresh plastic envelope inside the heavier body pouch so that any trace evidence would be preserved. He also took possession of the victim's purse and locked it in a drawer in his office on Knox Street. It was after midnight before the scene alongside the Sunset Highway was cleared, and the many men and women working there with measuring tapes and sketch pads were all gone. This death was not a normal death, nor was it an accident. It was almost certainly a homicide, one that investigators felt confident would be solved in 48 hours, just as Washington County's other homicide that weekend was. A male murder victim had been found stabbed multiple times in western Washington County on Friday, September 19th. By 6 o'clock on Sunday night, police had arrested and charged the suspected killer. But the investigators on this new homicide were wrong when they expected a quick solution. It was as if they were grasping the end of a thread, expecting to pull it loose. They could not know that the thread was only one infinitesimal piece of a fabric so snarled and tangled that it might well have been woven by a madman. And, in a certain sense, it had been. Chapter 2. The good weather on the weekend of September 19th to the 21st, 1986, made little difference to Dr. Sarah Gordon. She was working on trauma call at Providence Hospital in Portland, and there was no day or night, no sense of the seasons in the operating rooms. The only sounds were muted voices or the music some surgeons preferred. The only lights were focused on the operating field. Trauma duty is by its very nature unpredictable. Sarah Gordon often worked a full day's shift and all through the night, too. She was an anesthesiologist called in for emergency treatment of accident victims or for the innumerable surgeries that couldn't wait, some life-threatening and some more routine. A beautiful, delicate woman, Sarah looked more like a kindergarten teacher than a physician. She had huge blue eyes and dimples, and her figure was slender and petite. In truth, she was a workhorse, a woman whose hand was steady no matter if blood might spray chaotically from a nicked artery in the patient she hovered over, no matter if a heart stopped beating or lungs stopped expanding. She had struggled too many years to win her medical degree to be anything less than professional, and she often worked 60 hours a week napping in the on-call suite between operations. Sarah Gordon had grown up in McMinnville, Oregon, one of 10 children. She and her sister Marin were identical twins, but mirror-image twins.
"I'm right-handed," Sarah would explain. "My twin is left-handed. We're identical but opposite. Math and science were always easy for me, and Marin was the creative one. When I graduated from high school with a 4.0 grade point average and she got a 3.8, she felt dumb, but it was only because I had a slight edge in math."
Looking at Sarah and Marin, their teachers couldn't tell them apart, and they played the usual twin pranks, attending class for each other, fooling their friends. They would always be close, but as adults they would look more like just sisters than twins. Sarah was thinner, her blonde hair lighter than Marin's, and her face often showed signs of stress, perhaps to be expected in her profession. All the Gordon children were intelligent. One brother was an attorney. Another was a millionaire who owned thousands of acres of prime Oregon grazing land and as many head of prize cattle. Their grandfather pioneered in the Lake Oswego suburb of Portland long before it became a suburban paradise. Grandfather Cruz's land turned out to be virtually worth its weight in gold. His old house, barns, and outbuildings remained in Lake Oswego just as they always were, but they were surrounded by posh homes, condos, office buildings, and parkways. Sarah's father was not rich, however, and it was a struggle to raise his large family. He was a dairy farmer, and dairy farmers rarely have the money to finance medical school. Sarah's parents had no money even to send her to college, much less medical school, and, like the rest of her siblings, she worked her way through college, graduating from Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, in 1973 with a Bachelor of Science degree. At Willamette, she dated a young man who would one day be a deputy district attorney in Washington County, Oregon. She also knew Mike Shinn, who was a football star at Willamette, and would become a prominent civil attorney in Portland. She never dated Shinn, and they didn't expect to see each other much after college. Sarah had always wanted to be a doctor. Most of the men who were attracted to her didn't take her ambition seriously. She was too pretty, too diminutive, and she was always so concerned about other people's feelings. Maybe she didn't fit the accepted picture of a physician, but she was completely committed to achieving her goal. Sarah married a young teacher who convinced her he supported her dream of a career in medicine. He didn't, not really. He wanted a stay-at-home wife. Accepted at Oregon Health Sciences University in 1974, she decided not to go. She tried to be a perfect housewife, but she yearned to continue her education, and after a frustrating year in Astoria on the coast of Oregon, her marriage ended. Sarah also had to convince the University of Oregon's medical school in Portland that she was really serious. Her application was passed over in 1975, but she was finally reaccepted in 1976, and she put herself through medical school by working as a cocktail waitress at a Red Lion Inn in Astoria. The job was far afield from her ultimate ambition, but the tips were good, and she had the perfect figure for the abbreviated outfits she had to wear. Sarah's second marriage worked, even though she began medical school in 1976, probably because her husband's job kept him out at sea as much as he was ashore. She wanted very much to prove that she could succeed at marriage, but she also wanted desperately to be a doctor. She was able to juggle the demands of medical school and marriage until 1980, when she received her degree. But when she began a four-year residency in anesthesiology at the same medical school, her second marriage ended too. There was just no time for anything but her career. Nevertheless, she tried again during her residency, this time with a physician, but her third marriage was as abbreviated as the first two. In 1984, she finally finished her residency and established her own practice as an anesthesiologist. She regretted her three failed marriages, but they had all ended with little acrimony. She still worked with her last ex-husband, Dr. Jeff Morrow, head of the Contagious Disease Department at Providence. Theirs was an amicable, if final, divorce. Perhaps she just wasn't meant to be married. Sarah was 33, and she had been in school for 28 years of her life. She still had medical school loans to pay back, and she worked every extra shift she could at Providence Hospital. But despite her native intelligence and her sophistication in all things medical, she was a trusting, almost naive woman. Because she always told the truth and took great pains never to hurt anyone's feelings, she tended to believe that other people worked under the same moral code. When it came to evaluating men, Sarah had made some misjudgments. She had never expected to be divorced even once, much less three times. Without children, with little trust in the permanency of relationships between men and women, Sarah had immersed herself in her career, doubtful that she would ever find true love. There was another obstacle. She earned so much more money than most men that many of the eligible males she was attracted to were scared off. It would take a highly confident and liberated man to feel secure dating a woman who was not only beautiful and extremely intelligent, but whose projected income was close to $500,000 a year. And she certainly didn't want a man who was attracted to her because of her money. In the spring of 1986, Sarah was dating Jack Kincaid, who had a successful advertising agency with several offices on the West Coast. Kincaid was divorced with two teenage daughters, and he was a confirmed born-again bachelor. He and Sarah were not dating exclusively. Kincaid was also seeing a woman in her 20s. If Sarah had been completely frank about her feelings, she would have admitted to a smidgen of jealousy about that. But even so, she and Kincaid were good friends. She counted on his being around, and she didn't expect that he would commit either to her or to his other girlfriend, Sandy. One night, Sarah and Jack and her friend Lilia Sarnen, who was dating one of Sarah's fellow doctors, Clay Watson, were attending a dance at the Multnomah Athletic Club, the MAC, one of Portland's more exclusive clubs. Lilia didn't feel that Jack was good for Sarah. He was too much of a playboy. When the men were away from the table, Lilia expressed her feelings and said she knew the perfect man for Sarah. She wanted to set her up with a blind date with an old friend of hers. "His name is Brad Cunningham," Lilia said. Sarah wasn't looking for anyone else to date, and, like almost everyone else, she hated blind dates. Men that friends described as really fascinating too often turned out to be anything but. Nevertheless, Lilia persisted. She had once dated Brad Cunningham herself. Now she was happy with Clay Watson, Lilia said, but she and Brad were still friends. He was newly single, and she felt he and Sarah would be a perfect fit. She described him as a very special man. Actually, Lilia went into such graphic detail about how skilled Brad Cunningham was as a lover that Sarah was a little embarrassed. She had never heard a woman speak so openly about a man. Indeed, she wondered why, if this Brad was such a marvelous lover, Lilia had let him get away. But she said she had no romantic interest in Cunningham any longer, and she thought Sarah would like him. A little reluctantly, Sarah said it would be all right for him to call her.
"He got my phone number from Lilia," she later recalled. "He phoned me, and we agreed to meet for dinner. I had a date with Jack that week, the last week in March, too, and he had to change the date, so I called Brad, and we switched days."
Sarah spoke to Lilia early on the day of her blind date. She kept talking about the relationship they had had, how she had been in love with him. "I still thought it was weird that she'd want to introduce me to Brad, but she insisted." Sarah had no intention of meeting Brad Cunningham alone. What would they talk about? She didn't even know him. So she arranged to have her friend Ginny Burton, who worked as an operating room technician at Providence, and Ginny's boyfriend Gil come to dinner that night, too. "I was in a security building, so I could see Brad on the monitor when he buzzed to get in," Sarah remembered. "I went down and met him. He was very good-looking." In fact, Brad Cunningham looked as if he wouldn't need someone to fix him up with a blind date. When Sarah let him in, she found him tremendously attractive. He was a big, broad-shouldered man with thick dark hair and slow eyes. He appeared to be a few years older than she was. He dressed impeccably, and he had an air of success about him. He was certainly self-assured. Too self-assured for Sarah's taste. "I didn't like him on our first date," she recalled. "He talked too much about Lilia and about himself, and he seemed egotistical." Brad monopolized the conversation that first night, while Sarah, Ginny, and Gil listened politely. "It was very obvious that Brad had once had a lot of money," Sarah remembered. But his conversation about his wealth and his possessions didn't impress her. Besides that, Brad seemed so taken with Lilia Saarinen that Sarah wondered why he wasn't still dating her. She had raved about Brad, and now Brad kept going on about her. "I really thought that he wouldn't be interested in me because he kept talking about Lilia." Easter Sunday was on March 30th that year. Although she had expected him to, Jack Kincaid didn't invite Sarah out for Easter brunch. It didn't really bother her. He said he was going to take his daughters out to brunch. "I told him I'd just leave his Easter basket on his front porch," Sarah said. Kincaid looked uncomfortable when he said, "You'd better not do that, Sarah. I'm going to be with Sandy." Sarah didn't take an Easter basket to Jack Kincaid, and she accepted a second date with Brad Cunningham when he called. Even though her 3 months of dating Kincaid hadn't been an exclusive arrangement, her feelings were a little hurt that he was with Sandy. She undoubtedly said yes to another date with Brad Cunningham more quickly than she ordinarily would have. She was glad she did. "On our second date, Brad was charming," she said. "He asked about me." Sarah figured that he had been just as nervous about their first date as she was. He wasn't really conceited. He had just been hiding his own discomfort and trying too hard to fill the conversational silences. After all, he hadn't known Sarah or her friends that first night. The man Sarah met for their second date was considerate and concerned, and she found herself extremely drawn to him. Her feelings for Brad were not what she had expected, but there it was. She was surprised at how wrong she had been about him. Every time she saw him, she liked him better. And from the beginning, she had found him physically attractive, not classically handsome, but there was something about him. Maybe it was his eyes. Bradley Morris Cunningham was not yet 40, but he was a bank executive at Citizens Savings and Loan. And shortly after he met Sarah, he had a new job. He was hired to be part of the top echelon of the Spectrum Corporation, a branch of the U.S. Bank in Portland. He told Sarah he would oversee all of their commercial acquisitions. He also told her he had been a real estate entrepreneur involved in a huge project in Houston, Texas, where he had controlled $600 million. Although that project had gone sour when the oil disaster hit Houston, Brad said he had brought suit against his contractor and the bonding company, litigation that, he said, would eventually net him millions of dollars. And as if that weren't enough, Brad also had his own company which had diversified interests, some having to do with construction and others in the biotechnology field. Sarah and Brad dated often that spring, going out to dinner and to plays. He invited her to his home, a two-bedroom apartment on the 14th floor of the Madison Tower along the Willamette River in downtown Portland. Brad introduced Sarah to his 15-year-old son, Brent, who lived with him, a child of his first marriage. He told her he had two daughters, Amy and Kate by former marriages, and three other sons, Jess, Michael, and Philip, who were 6, 4, and 2, respectively. By the end of April, Sarah had also met Brad's younger sons. They were adorable little boys with their father's dark hair and eyes, polite and endearing children. "I thought they were wonderful," Sarah remembered. Brad told Sarah that he shared custody of his three younger boys with his estranged wife. He planned to move to a larger apartment on the 18th floor where they would have their own room furnished and decorated especially for them. The little boys were with him as much as they were with their mother. Sarah was touched when she saw how deeply Brad cared for his children. He seemed to build his whole life around them. He confided that their mother was totally unfit and that he was struggling to gain full custody of the boys. He described his ex-wife to Sarah as bitchy. Sarah remembered his words. "He said she would fly off the handle and yell at the kids. He told me she was sexually promiscuous, but that he really thought she hated men." Sarah's heart went out to Brad. He was so worried about his kids that it seemed to color his whole life, and she saw the shadows of pain wash across his face when he thought she wasn't looking. Even so, she found Brad fun, bright, and attractive. She had met very few men in her life who were not intimidated by her intelligence and her income. Not this man. Brad had a remarkably keen mind, and Sarah found him more and more fascinating. His lifestyle and his interests were different from anything she had ever known. But there was an almost electric energy about him. He was enthusiastic and charismatic, and he had risen so high so rapidly in the business world. Incredibly, just when Sarah had pretty much reconciled herself to being alone, Portland's spring of 1986 surprised her. It brought not only its usual profusion of rhododendrons, azaleas, and dogwood blossoms, but also this remarkable man who seemed to be ideal for her. She stopped seeing Jack Kincaid, and Jack dated Sandy exclusively. Sarah and Jack were still friendly. It was just that they rarely met any longer. Brad Cunningham was everything that Sarah had ever imagined she would want in a husband, and he had come along just at the time when she believed she would never find anyone. It was funny how life turned out sometimes. That the two of them should ever have met and fallen in love defied the laws of probability. Their backgrounds were so different. Sarah was Dutch. Brad was half Indian, half Celtic. She was small and blonde. He was large and dark. They were both, however, determined and ambitious people who could focus on a goal and channel all their energies until they achieved it. Before April blossomed into May, Brad and Sarah were extremely close. "He waited a long time before he would make love to me," she recalled. "And that was thoughtful. He told me that he didn't want to be intimate until he was sure that we were going to stay together." Brad proved to be both a tender and an exciting lover.
a caring, passionate man. He told me over and over again how much he loved me, how beautiful I was, Sarah said. He was always telling me what a lucky man he was to be with me, how lucky his boys were.
Sarah had every reason to believe that Brad loved her.
A nurse friend of mine told me after a party that it was obvious Brad was in love with me, she remembered. She said he never took his eyes off me the whole evening.
Sarah felt just as lucky to have found Brad. It was a transcendently perfect spring for both of them. Brad gave her a friendship ring, which they both knew meant a commitment that far exceeded friendship. He urged her to rent an apartment in the Madison Tower so that they could be closer together. The three round towers, Madison, Grant, and Lincoln, were the place to live in Portland in 1986. Their windows looked out on a renewed riverfront, on all the arching bridges that cross the Willamette River to connect the bisected city, and on the long park blocks that are not unlike Manhattan's Central Park. Brad had moved to a three-bedroom unit on the 18th floor where the rent was $1,000 a month. In June, Sarah found a unit she liked on the 14th floor. It was $800 a month. In New York, Chicago, or San Francisco, their apartments would have rented for at least three times as much. The rooms were large and tasteful, and there was an outside walkway running around each floor of the soaring towers. Basement parking facilities were available to all tenants. It was, of course, a security building where no one gained entrance to the tower elevators without permission of the guards on duty. Coincidentally, Brad's former girlfriend Lilia Sarnan, who had been responsible for bringing Brad and Sarah together, lived in an apartment on the ground floor of the Madison Tower. That didn't concern Sarah. Although Lilia was a very sexy woman, it was apparent that whatever she and Brad had shared was over, and Lilia was in love with her surgeon boyfriend, Dr. Clay Watson. He was two decades older than Lilia, but that didn't bother her at all. She was a pragmatic woman, and Watson took wonderful care of her. Like Brad, Lilia had a career in banking, but her health was unpredictable. She needed someone like Watson. Sarah and Lilia were very different types. While Sarah was sweetly feminine, Lilia's style was subdued. She chose loose clothing in earth tones, pulled her long hair back in a bun, and wore horn-rimmed glasses. Even so, men seemed to find her almost bland but perfect features spectacularly sensuous. She had a manner about her that suggested a sexuality barely under wraps. She spoke softly, as Sarah did, but Lilia had hidden promises in her voice. Sarah was not surprised that Brad had been attracted to Lilia, but now he was completely devoted to her. He had turned her life upside down, and she was gloriously happy that summer. She was so much in love that she never felt fatigued, even though she was working such brutal hours in the trauma unit. It seemed as though everything she had longed for in life was suddenly within her grasp. Sarah adored children, although she had never been lucky enough to have any of her own. She had found Brad's three young sons delightful from the moment he introduced them to her. Jess, Michael, and Philip were as smart as their father and well-behaved. Sarah and Brad took the boys sailing on a week's vacation, and it was as if they were already a family. Sarah hated to say goodbye to them when they went back to their mother, and she worried about them. Brad had come to trust Sarah so much that he gradually revealed more and more about what their mother was really like. He confided that she called the children four-letter words and screamed at them continually. The custody of his little boys was desperately important to Brad. All of his business success meant nothing, not if his children were being mistreated. That summer, Brad and his estranged wife wrangled constantly about the boys. It was the one shadow over Sarah's happiness. She heard Brad argue with his wife on the phone, though she never really saw the acrimony between them. She accompanied him sometimes when he went to pick up his sons, but she never spoke to his wife. "I saw her working in her yard," Sarah recalled. "Once we took the boys back and she came running up holding her arms out for Philip, but we never talked." Sarah worried about what effect all this was having on the boys, but she tried to stay out of the arguments. It wasn't her place to interfere, and she was confident that Brad could handle things in the best way for his sons. Sarah continued to pay the rent on her 14th-floor apartment in the Madison Tower that summer, but she spent so little time there that it seemed like an empty space with no human energy. "I kept my clothes in my apartment, but I was basically living in Brad's apartment," she said. His apartment reflected both his taste and his ability to buy the best. He even had a baby grand piano, although he couldn't play. It was only natural that Sarah wanted to spend her few off-duty hours with Brad. "I was very much in love with him, and I thought he was very much in love with me." She had no reason to think otherwise. Brad assured her many times a day of his love. He was always on time to meet her or pick her up. He was always where he said he would be, and their time together was wonderful. In a sense, it was as if they were both recouping the years they had lost in bad relationships. Sarah knew that Brad had been married 4 times and that he had been disappointed in love just as she had. But now, finally, almost serendipitously, they had found each other. They were both under 40, and they could plan for so many good years together. Except for all the hassle that Brad was having with his wife over the custody of Jess, Michael, and Philip, Sarah's and Brad's lives were idyllic. Her practice was well established, his business interests seemed to be booming, they loved each other, and they planned to get married as soon as Brad was divorced. Their days had fallen into a happy pattern. When Sarah wasn't working at Providence, she was with Brad. Every other weekend, they planned their time around Jess, Michael, and Philip. And on the weekends that Sarah was on call, as she often was, Brad took the boys to the park blocks or entertained them in his apartment. He had the boys in the middle of the week for a few days, too. It seemed that he and his wife had calibrated their joint custody almost down to the minute. Sarah sensed that Brad was often sad, and he finally confessed to her that his wife was continuing to make his life miserable. Sarah wondered just what kind of woman she was. Why did she have to make everything so difficult? Sarah knew that she was a successful attorney, but she certainly sounded like a terrible mother. Brad needed Sarah, and not just because he was having such a bitter struggle to protect his sons. He suffered a wrenching loss in July. Sarah was at Providence on an overnight shift when Brad called. He had just learned that his father, Sanford Cunningham, had died of a heart attack at his fishing cabin in Darrington, Washington. "He was sobbing so hard I could barely understand him," Sarah remembered. "He needed me, and I managed to find someone to cover for me so I could go home and be with him." Sarah knew how close Brad had been to his father, and she tried to help him and his stepmother Mary, too. She went with Brad and the boys to